So good evening, everyone. My name is Ayça Çubukçu. I'm an assistant professor in human rights at the LSE. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the school tonight and introduce our speaker, Professor Vasuki Nesia from New York University. The title of Vasuki's talk tonight is Indebted, Leaning into Empowerment. And this talk is being brought to you by the Internationalism, Cosmopolitanism, and Politics of Solidarity Research Group that I convene at LSE, as well as the King's College London Transnational Institute of Law and the Center for Critical International Law at Kent Law School. Let me introduce our speaker briefly. She has a long list of accomplishments, and I will not be mentioning everything. But I think you should be exposed to the kind of work Vasuki has been doing. As I mentioned, Vasuki Nesia is associate professor at New York University and a legal scholar with a focus on public international law. Her main areas of research include the law and politics of international human rights and humanitarianism, with a particular focus on transitional justice. Her past publications have engaged with international feminisms and the history of colonialism in international law. She has also written on the politics of memory and comparative constitutionalism, with a particular focus on law and politics in South Asia. Her most immediate project includes a volume which she co-edited with Louis Esleva and Michael Fakhri, A Global History of Bandung and Critical Traditions in International Law, with Cambridge University Press. Professor Nesia teaches human rights, law and social theory, and the politics of war and memory at NYU. She continues as core faculty in Harvard Law School's Institute for Global Law and Policy. In this capacity, she has taught for 6 years in the IGLP workshops in Cambridge, Doha, and Cape Town. She is, most importantly, perhaps at least to me, one of the founding members of the Third World Approaches to International Law, and has continued as an active participant in this global network of scholars for 2+ decades. Vasuki serves on the international editorial committees of the journals Feminist Legal Studies and the London Review of International Law, based here in London. She also serves on the International Advisory Board of the Institute of International Law and the Humanities at the University of Melbourne, and is an Associate Fellow with the Asia Society in New York. Prior to joining NYU, Professor Nesia taught in the International Relations and Gender Studies concentrations at Brown University. She has held positions at Columbia University, and I'm shortening her background here, but she has degrees from Cornell University. She has been a visiting student at Oxford University, and she has her JD and SJD from Harvard Law School. She has also been awarded a fellowship at Columbia Law School. It is such a tremendous pleasure and honor to welcome Dr. Vasuki Nesia to the LSE tonight. And without further ado, and with much excitement, we look forward to your talk. Thank you.
Thanks, Ayça. That was like everything from kindergarten to anyone I knew remotely. So thank you very much. It's such a thrill to be here. I'm actually, maybe I'll sit down in the end, because it's a bit irregular. So I use this, right? So thanks, everyone, for coming. I was going to read this whole thing, but maybe I'll skip one part of it. Maybe it'll save us 10 minutes. I'm not sure how much it'll save. I'm a bit anxious about editing as I go, because I'm terrible at it. But it's a great pleasure to be here, and so feel free to interrupt me. I mean, feel free to treat it as informally as possible. The paper I'm going to present today is in a book that Prabha is co-editing, so it gives me particular pleasure to present it along with others on governance feminism from in various context and so on. So I'll read it, and as I said, feel free to interrupt at any point. So the paper is called "Indebted: The Cruel Optimism of Leaning into Empowerment." Lauren Ballant argues that one dimension of the cruelty of life under late capitalism is that we get attached to a cluster of promises regarding the good life that are generated by and embedded in conditions that are already not working. Thus, we get attached to the very conditions that defeat the fulfillment of those promises. The difficulty of detaching from these compromised conditions of possibility trap us in a state of prolonged crisis, an impasse that naturalizes crisis into our ordinary. Ballant called this emotion cruel optimism and notes that it introduces into our intimate and public lives a state of crisis ordinariness. This seems a particularly acute characterization of the structural function of financial debt for the economically vulnerable. Access to credit seduces with cruel optimism. It is intertwined with a cluster of promises regarding the good life, while this attachment to living on credit is embedded in conditions of economic dystopia that are precarious and unsustainable. The effective structure of empowerment in enabling and even easing access to credit precisely for those most financially vulnerable produces cruel optimism. Within feminist development economics, empowerment is an agential participatory vision that shapes development policy, at once legitimizing that policy and produces crisis ordinariness in its subjects. This chapter probes the work done by the promise of women's empowerment in post-conflict environments. It focuses particularly on the empowerment program of international financial institutions and development agencies in the arena of market-oriented post-conflict economic development. In these contexts, interventions that seek to advance empowerment by enhancing women's access to credit, property title, and entrepreneurship have been significant elements of the development policy apparatus. This paper is interested in how particular feminist ideas about the empowerment of women become part of the knowledge apparatus of institutions shaping economic governance in post-conflict environments, and concomitantly how these ideas traveled into policies and processes that had far-reaching effects on the ground, although not necessarily effects that were intended or anticipated. This chapter looks at the coming together of feminism and international development in projects advancing women's integration into the private sector in conflict and post-conflict environments. It does this partly by looking at how empowerment emerged as a nodal point for feminist development policy, and partly by looking at how one large-scale multi-donor development project in collaboration with the UN and the Sri Lankan government, called the Owner-Driven Housing Assistance Program, has interfaced with debt regimes in post-conflict Sri Lanka. The ODHA program for housing development, now completed, was aimed at providing the war displaced the means to permanent shelter in the Sri Lankan post-war context, and offers a particularly important context to which we can track the work of empowerment discourse and projects of development agencies in post-conflict environments. ODHA also offers an interesting window to which to track how feminist insights have become mainstreamed within development policy with particular reach in conflict post-conflict environments. Concerned that development policy marginalized women, feminists have sought to ensure that empowerment is a key goal of development through economic and sociological analysis on the one hand, and program development and political pressure on the other. They played a key role in developing the general policy and the specific ODHA program. Thus, this is a story about an emerging form of governance feminism. Four broad sections to this to the project. Section one focuses on the path of feminist interventions into development policy, the steering of that trajectory towards the promise of empowerment. An empowerment discourse had many trajectories, but the one that had risen, that had traction with development agencies and donors over the last two decades, converged not accidentally with neoliberal logics. In particular, property, credit, and entrepreneurship were able to travel under the aura of neoliberal promises, and that's kind of what I focus on in that first section. I then turn in section two to how feminism travels in the field of conflict and post-conflict development policy. In particular, I describe what I term international conflict feminism. And then in section three and four, I look at the intersections and convergences that brings together feminist development policy and ICF, international conflict feminism, in this ODHA program in Sri Lanka, in this housing development program. So like the overlapping zone sort of a Venn diagram, knowledge regimes of women's economic empowerment intersected with knowledge regimes about women in conflict and post-conflict environments and help shape and articulate interventions such as the Owner Development Housing Assistance Program. Finally, the concluding section locates the Sri Lankan case in relation to how governance feminism unfolds and gets articulated in this zone of intersection. It is a zone of intersection between different trajectories of feminism, one focused on development, the other focused on conflict, as well as between feminism and neoliberalism. In looking at the unprecedented debt burden that has emerged with these policies and the distributive and other implications of debt in the context of ODHA, of post-conflict Sri Lanka, and of global economic governance, we have a window into the cruel optimism of disappearing futures. So the first section is probably what I will sort of go through really fast, or we'll try and at least cut off a certain section about it, and that's basically traces the history of women in development and the ways in which, from the 50s on, different feminist engagement, different phases and modes of feminist engagement with sort of the development field in two different phases emerged in ways of making the development field take gender into account in a whole range of different ways. And partly where I end up, going through sort of the different kinds of the world conferences on women in Mexico, in Nairobi, and sort of different kinds of moments, I come to, particular organizations like DAWN, which some of you may know, Development Alternatives for with Women for a New Era, a whole range of different individuals who also, I think many of you may have read, people like Geeta Sen and so on, the ways in which those come together in to focus on a notion of empowerment. And so I'll take up the story then in the 90s, where, at the moment when I say that the language of empowerment by then, through these various debates, has now become ubiquitous. That's 15 years after CEDAW spoke in the key of equality. The 1995 Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action mentions empowerment over 30 times. And you can see that sort of very real shift, in some sense, about the language through which women in development emerges. And its guidelines on empowerment, the UN Population Fund, for instance, offers a consolidated definition to guide its activities. It says, women's empowerment has five components: women's sense of self-worth, their right to have and determine choices, their right to have access to opportunities and resources, their right to have the power to control their own lives, both within and outside the home, and the ability to influence the direction of social change to create a more just social and economic order nationally and internationally. Close quotes. The UNFPA sees these guidelines as reflecting awareness gained over all of the major international conferences of the 1990s, affirming the centrality of women's empowerment to the success of development programs. The feminist embrace of the notion of empowerment reflected an effort to foreground women as the agents of change, not as the targets of policy. In an influential background paper to UNDP's 1997 Human Development Report, Geeta Sen argued that in contrast to the received orthodoxy of welfare-driven poverty alleviation, in development programs premised on empowerment, governments do not empower people, people empower themselves. What government policies and actions can do is to create what she calls a supportive environment or act as a barrier to the empowerment process. Thus, women's empowerment was also embedded in a larger effort to democratize development and link grassroots participation to socioeconomic transformation. Today, the vocabulary of empowerment has been mainstreamed into the international development field. The 2013 Agenda for Sustainable Development presents all 17 SDGs as integrated and indivisible in seeking to realize human rights for all, achieve gender equality, and empower all women and girls. This includes the post-conflict development field, where, as one World Bank paper on post-conflict reconstruction notes, many of the key actors involved in post-conflict reconstruction have specific policies on gender mainstreaming and the empowerment of women. So women's empowerment is partly sort of empty buzzword, but it's partly a way to gesture to policies favoring a participatory approach to development. Yet it is clear that many strands of feminist development ideology that were audible in the 1975 International Conference on Women in Mexico are much less audible in the empowerment discourse sounding from institutions such as the World Bank today. In 1995, the very capaciousness of the Beijing conference allowed for different stands of feminism to project their own diverse, even contradictory development ideologies onto the empowerment language captured in the declaration. In the path from the Beijing Declaration to the World Bank paper on post-conflict reconstruction, the discourse of empowerment has been narrowed in ways that facilitated its travel and uptake. For instance, for Sen, the language of empowerment was a way to flag what she referred to as the multidimensionality of poverty and speak of the socioeconomic in ways that highlighted the politics of economics. In contrast, as the language of empowerment got mainstreamed into the international development agencies and financial institutions, it was often equated with the narrowly economistic. Empowerment traveled as individual financial empowerment with little attention to context, culture, and social relations. To this end, empowerment often got delinked from politics, and empowerment via income generation became a project of development knowledge. This process was well underway in the 1990s and accelerated after the 95 Beijing conference. Thus, key actors in the development field developed methodologies to promote women's empowerment, such as lists of best practices for implementation of policy commitment to economic empowerment. If the socio-political context mattered, as it did for Sen and the Global South feminists at the 75 Mexico conference, one could not produce best practices that could travel with ease. However, in the post-Beijing world, a development agency might invoke knowledge of a women's income-generating activity in a country X to develop a program in country Y in the name of empowerment. And those kinds of projects proliferated, right, and as they continue today. UN Women developed a set of principles for women's empowerment to offer practical guidance to business and the private sector on how to empower women in the workplace, marketplace, and community. The IMF integrated empowerment into best practices for economic recovery more generally, touting empowering women as smart economics. The World Map published what it called a roadmap to women's empowerment to identify what it described as proven, promising, and high-potential interventions to promote women's economic advancement and increase women's productivity and earnings worldwide. Thus, gradually we see in different ways in different institutions involved in the development enterprise the proliferation of knowledge claims about interventions that will achieve empowerment, and implicitly therefore knowledge claims about what empowerment looks like. As this process became consolidated in institutional practices, empowerment policies focused, among other things, on encouraging women's access to property title, credit, and entrepreneurship. And in this way, UN Women advocated for women's land and property rights as part of its sort of core strategy. The World Bank highlights access to credit as a critical dimension of its new gender equality strategy, and USAID argues that women's participation in entrepreneurship can help expand these economies while also leading to greater equality in society. And these three programmatic goals were adopted as efforts to mainstream women's empowerment. Okay, I think I may sort of jump again in some sense. So I sort of elaborate a little bit on each of those things, on the access to property title, on credit, and on entrepreneurship, and the ways in those things get mainstreamed into ideas about best practices around development in a whole range of different contexts, how they link up with CEDAW in terms of, for instance, pulling together ideas in CEDAW about equality in property, property ownership, into ideas that are much more, that have a different pedigree linked to Hernando de Soto and others around property ownership, around title. Right? And similarly, the ideas in the World Bank report about access to credit, about framing credit as a feminist issue, access to credit as a feminist issue, and then therefore pushing for availability of credit as one way of addressing that. And then finally about empowerment discourse as well, about making entrepreneurship discourse as well, about thinking of women as economic agents, about the different ways in which these particular components, title, credit, and entrepreneurship, become in some sense part of a feminist agenda within institutions like the World Bank, or even in some sense the ILO, right? So with an emphasis on individualism and agency, ideas women's entrepreneurship, like microcredit and property rights, lodge nicely with the ideology of structural adjustment policies and the focus on private initiative rather than state initiative as the engine for economic growth. The convergence between these policy orientations and the discourse of empowerment in feminist development policy builds an effective structure tethering neoliberalism and feminism. Significantly, the affect is something we can read into the stance of feminist policy advocates of empowerment policies, even if not for the purported beneficiaries about whom we know little. Analysts of the policies championed by De Soto and others have argued that the biggest beneficiaries were elites positioned to profit from the market economy. Perhaps the same can be said of the policy elites positioned to profit from feminist development policies. In this context, governance feminism tethers the policy claims of neoliberalism and the normative claims of feminism to bring governance to feminism and vice versa. So the policy package of entrepreneurship, microcredit schemes, and individual property title may have particular resonance with the discourse of empowerment and the promise of the professional leaning in some sense, to define a future. Okay, so that was the development sort of backdrop in some sense. Sort of the second backdrop is feminism in what I call the sort of the conflict scene, what I describe as international conflict feminism. Right? So within the field of international development, the international agencies dealing with violence and the threat of violence treat violent conflict as akin to a fire that sweeps through a society and creates a fertile, depoliticized terrain for new beginnings. As Naomi Klein has argued in The Shock Doctrine, capitalism loves a crisis, and the unsettled political terrain that often characterize the aftermath of war and conflict are seen as fertile ground for pushing through neoliberal policy agendas before there can be organized opposition. And this is what she calls disaster capitalism. In fact, the dynamic that Klein identifies with capitalism is more generally true for international interventions in countries deemed to be conflict zones. The conflict or post-conflict environment is often invoked as a failed state, a terra nullius, that legitimizes external intervention to restore a model of governance that allows its people to march forward into history rather than be weighted down by primordial conflicts. So this is broadly the framing of the context, and because gender mainstreaming has reached post-conflict international management, this domain also colors itself gender-sensitive, inclusive, and non-discriminatory. The power of this dynamic is that it institutionalized knowledge about women's empowerment and post-conflict recovery has far-reaching structural and distributive effects, but it travels not as politics or as ideology, but as gender-sensitive post-conflict reconstruction. So UN Security Council Resolution 1325 on Women, Peace and Security, Its Birthing, Life and Legacy, offer an illustrative window into these dynamics. Passed by the Security Council in 2000, the Security Council Resolution 1325 becomes a central pivot point for a range of agendas at the nexus of women, peace and security, including in particular addressing impunity for sexual violence in conflict and the participation of women in the security sector. So as indicated, for instance, by the 2015 UN Global Study reviewing Security Council 1325's first 15 years, of the more than 2,200 resolutions adopted by the Security Council in its 7 decades of history, it is hard to think of one resolution that is better known for its name, number, and the content than Resolution 1325. So that global study describes SCR 1325 as born out of a truly global constituency of women's organizations and advocates. It is a constituency vision and framework that I've described in other work as international conflict feminism. ICF includes a complex of policies that take as their starting point the notion that women are victimized by conflict and excluded or marginalized in peace and security decision-making and post-conflict recovery. Against this backdrop, ICF sees remedies for that victimization and law and policy interventions directed at the inclusion and empowerment of women in conflict and post-conflict contexts. So ICF encourages a particular focus on women as victims of sexual violence and concomitantly a focus on prosecution of sexual violence crimes as an especially high priority. In addition to SCR 1325 and the Security Council resolutions that have followed, so basically produced, catalyzed a decade of Security Council resolutions focusing on women and conflict, ICF also manifests in the gender jurisprudence of international courts and tribunals, in post-conflict institution building, in nation-building initiatives, and in development and reconstruction policies and projects. As indicated in the 2015 UN Global Study, again, in each of these arenas, ICF emerges from and in turn organizes a global women's rights network. For instance, ICF jurisprudence in international courts and tribunals was shaped by lawyers and judges within these institutions, as well as an active, engaged community of feminist activists, scholars, and organizations that tracked, reviewed, and pressured the gender jurisprudence of these bodies. We see invocations of Security Council 1325 in support of ICF agendas within the bureaucratic apparatus of donors, international non-governmental organizations, and multilateral agencies such as the UN and the EU that shape funding lines, justice and rule of law initiatives and development projects. Such invocations reflect an ICF vision that has become the normative common sense regarding gender in conflict and post-conflict environments. The gendered subject who emerges from war and conflict in these policy depictions is represented as a particular kind of object of knowledge. Classically, women, both vulnerable and disempowered. However, in contrast to the therapeutic and prosecutorial sensibility that has accompanied the ICF approach to sexual violence, the dominant ICF, I use ICF as short for international conflict feminism, the dominant ICF sensibility in relation to economic devastation has been optimism and resilience. For instance, in dealing with sexual violence, ICF has framed sexual violence as one of the world's most vicious crimes, destroying individual lives and terrorizing communities, and that the full force of international order will be brought to bear to ensure accountability for sexual violence. In contrast, economic empowerment has often been framed as a process of unlocking latent potential, where women got to be key drivers of economic growth. So in one case, ICF emerges as victim, in the case of the economy, definitely as agent. That's the dominant, and a lot of the metaphors that are invoked are agential metaphors in that sense, right? Rather than a focus on victimhood and harm alone, the emphasis here has always been on agency and resilience, on women as economic actors. Both sides of the ICF women work in tandem, even when apparently in tension. Indeed, the backdrop of victimization gives added moral impetus to policy initiatives advancing empowerment. One example of this is a 2010 Secretary General's report on women's participation in peace building, which noted that there was an unprecedented support in the International Committee for robust action to ensure women's participation in peace building. This report outlined a 7-point action plan that included measures to capitalize on women's productive potential and ensure their economic empowerment. And significantly, women's agency is framed against a background habitus of victimhood, thus the potential emerges as all the more precious and warranting that much greater investment in empowerment. The knowledge economies that attach to the representation of the post-conflict woman as vulnerable but also resilient facilitate interventions that shape and regulate the discourse of accountability, recovery, and empowerment, accountability for sexual violence in war, recovery from war-related atrocities, and empowerment in peace processes and post-conflict reconstruction efforts. And then the focus on property, credit, and entrepreneurship as routes to empowerment gained particular traction, therefore, in the context of post-conflict development policy, sort of bringing together the development discussion and the conflict discussion. For in this post-conflict context are seen as presenting an historic opportunity to support gender-equal property inheritance, ownership, and control, because post-conflict reconstruction often involves sorting out property ownership, including lawmaking around property rights and privatization. Privatization of state land and property law measures, creating or entrenching fungible individual title, have then become a cornerstone of neoliberal economic development initiatives across the world. But the widespread displacement and destruction of war-torn countries have offered the advocates particularly fertile ground to lay a new foundation for free market activity by entrenching individual property rights. So it's a, you know, in some sense, an open oratory analysis again post-conflict shock doctrine, in some sense. Right? In similar way, in post-conflict context, microcredit has been advocated for as a route to poverty reduction, conflict mitigation, and equality. I've sort of jumped through that section, but in section on development, when I'm discussing credit, I speak in particular about how microcredit becomes in the face of and why it's advocated for as a feminist project at giving women access to credit. And so that becomes particularly popular, again, in conflict contexts, right? The availability of credit and schemes to give women access to credit. Accordingly, mainstreaming gender into financial services and particularly access to credit have become a critical focus of feminist approaches in post-conflict contexts. Finally, against a dominant story of women as victims of war, post-war economic policy is advanced as opening the possibility of a new dawn for exercising women's agency. Indeed, female entrepreneurship has been heralded as a peace-building tool with donor programs aimed at trade across women's trade between women across ethnic lines and market activity equated with reconciliation. So you have in this context, like women, you know, various entrepreneurship projects that, again, the bank and other agencies have about, you know, in Sri Lanka, Sinhalese and Tamil women trading, Palestinian women and Israeli women trading, and, you know, all of these things that are framed as therefore feminist projects, right? Transitional contexts have been advanced as offering particularly hospitable ground for the notion of an empowered female economic actor who can attain economic emancipation by navigating the market in ways that are autonomous of context, culture, and background, socio-economic conditions. So these three anchors of empowerment feed into each other. Title, property, ownership is promoted as enabling collateral to support credit access. Similarly, access to credit is promoted as critical for women's economic agency and self-reliance as entrepreneurs driving market-oriented economic recovery. Moreover, strikingly, new synergies have fueled this momentum amongst policymakers, donors, international agencies, and NGOs. For instance, Hernando de Soto's approach to housing and credit has come together with decentralized participatory development approaches in ways that echo the language of entrepreneurship as well as the language of grassroots democratization. The feminist interventions that have been mainstreamed into dominant post-conflict economic reconstruction programs have then been those mostly assimilated into policies aimed at market-oriented growth and integration of post-conflict economies into global markets. Okay, so against that background, I now sort of want to focus particularly on Sri Lanka and this particular example example that I take of owner-driven housing assistance. Okay, so the 30-year war in Sri Lanka ended in 2009. Post-war Sri Lanka quickly emerged as a magnet for various recovery and reconstruction efforts. These initiatives were shaped by various policy traditions, including neoliberal development theory and feminism. The feminist insights that we saw most prominently were those that emerged from feminist development work with the added inflection of ICF, international conflict feminism. Feminism was articulated in governance through these converging and intertwined traditions. This post-war Sri Lanka and the Housing Reconstruction Project, ODHA, offers a particularly rich terrain to examine the dynamics of governance feminism, and in this particular case, to examine how governance feminism becomes attached to debt regimes. So Sri Lanka has a long feminist tradition and many indicators of women's well-being in social development parlance. However, over the years, there has been much discussion about how the celebrated social development indicators regarding gender equality understates women's disempowerment. For instance, writing in 2000, Nilathi D'Souza, coordinator of a strategic planning unit for the Sri Lankan Office of INGO World Vision, of the INGO World Vision, writes that there's a hidden dimension to the image presented in printed statistics. That although the level of gender development in Sri Lanka is higher than average for an Asian country, gender empowerment is relatively low. So this focus on empowerment gets heightened with the focus on conflict, with much discussion of female-headed households, war widows, and women's particular economic precarity in conflict and post-conflict environments. And with the passage of 1325 in 2000, it is international conflict feminism and its investment in the dominant governance paradigm that shapes the international development and human rights community's approach to gender analysis and proposed policy interventions when engaging with Sri Lanka. So it goes to sort of several different examples of different kinds of projects from, let's say, International Alert, the World Bank again, World Vision again, various kinds of civil society action groups, many of whom that speak of Sri Lanka as a context where of women's disempowerment and women's precarity, where there is in fact a need for intervention in the name of post-conflict development, as well as in the name of feminism more generally. Right? And in this way, in the field of post-conflict development assistance has generated a knowledge apparatus that normalizes these assumptions. For instance, the bank has developed a toolkit on encouraging female entrepreneurship that includes how-to modules and advice on best practices, and publishes reports offering policy advice on strengthening women's own firms through individual property rights and access to credit services. An earlier FAO study on rural women in Sri Lanka's post-conflict rural economy noted that there had been a dramatic decline in socioeconomic indicators for rural women. In another recent study of women in war-affected regions of Sri Lanka, financial instability is described as foremost amongst the most pervasive economic, physical, and psychosocial vulnerabilities that female heads of households in the north face in the post-war context. So against this background, the rest of this section analyzes one of the programs implemented in Sri Lanka that comes, you know, against, in some sense, draws from and is shaped by these different kinds of traditions of intervention, and namely post-war housing reconstruction that was shaped by an international conflict feminism analysis of the problem and of the solution. Right. This analysis, in turn, built on the structural adjustment inflected approaches to empowerment to development that we've already discussed, and in the convergence of these various traditions of feminism and development policy. The housing program implemented in Sri Lanka allows us to track how governance feminism unfolded in the details of a development program. So the housing problem that I describe is called owner-driven housing. And owner-driven housing is something that's, you know, not particular to Sri Lanka, something that emerged emerged earlier, but has been but was one important intervention. It is not the only approach to housing reconstruction in Sri Lanka, but was one very big and prominent approach to housing reconstruction in Sri Lanka, right? Particularly in the northern province, where after the context of the war. So in 2009, after a 30-year civil war, when Sri Lanka moved from the desks of conflict resolution experts to the desk of post-conflict recovery experts, this reclassification signaled a range of discursive shifts from the realm of extraordinary crisis to the realm of crisis ordinariness, from knowledge of women as the victims of war to knowledge of women as the agents of reconstruction. One critical dimension of the post-war landscape has been this massive investment in the physical infrastructure of the country, including the rebuilding of the housing stock in the northern and eastern regions of the country that were the primary war zone for much of those three decades. Development experts saw housing as a linchpin to address many dimensions of the war, from internal displacement to economic recovery. And owner development housing emerges against that context. There are, as I said, other different approaches that take alternative approaches to the housing assistance in some ways equally or more problematic. But this is the in some sense the program which has been most invested and most shaped in some sense by feminist and participatory development theorists in some sense. So the Owner Development Housing Assistance Program is a product of a collaboration between the government of Sri Lanka, donor countries such as India, which is funding through the largest of this project, but also Australia and the EU, and multilateral agencies such as the World Bank and UN Habitat. ODHA had the promise of being more responsive to community needs and was driven by a participatory model of housing reconstruction. However, ODHA was accompanied by its own complexities and unintended outcomes, and that these complexities and unintended outcomes are sort of what I'll focus on in the rest of this paper. So ODHA sought to engender post-conflict reconstruction and economic recovery in previously war-torn regions of Sri Lanka through seed grants of approximately ₹500,000 for individual home building. So the grant was dispersed in installments through the course of the building program. Homeowners were expected to contribute their own labor, oversight of the home building, and any supplementary costs incurred by housing plans that went beyond the prototype. So in contrast, for instance, to a housing program that is sort of top-down, that is government-driven, this was seen as something that was participatory, that individual homeowners would actually shape. So it was seen as something that was also empowering. Recipients were residents in war-torn areas whose homes had been destroyed. As a UN Habitat report on this housing program describes it, it says vulnerable groups, including female-headed households, elderly homeowners, and the disabled, were given priority assistance. So donors based their grants on meeting almost the full cost of a model home, a prototype that they developed in consultation with the Sri Lankan government. And while the ODHA grant was calculated on the basis of this predetermined prototype of a two-bedroom house, households were permitted to go beyond that prototype, with the households, how homeowners were able to galvanize supplementary sources of funding. Most households sought to supplement their ODHA seed grants by taking advantage of financial instruments, credit, or taking advantage of schemes encouraging entrepreneurial activities for income generation. So you can see in some sense how these different pieces are beginning to come together, the credit, home ownership or title, property title, and entrepreneurship. Owner-driven housing entered the international donor repertoire not as neoliberal policy, but as a populist participatory development initiative undertaken in Latin America in the 1960s. For many decades, community development advocates in many parts of the world pushed against top-down housing programs. And in the decades following Bretton Woods, multilateral institutions such as the World Bank, donor agencies such as USAID, and recipient governance across the Global South undertook large-scale infrastructure projects. So many activists and scholars such as Arturo Escobar, James Ferguson, Wolfgang Sachs criticized these projects as designed in advance in ways that were calibrated with the interests of the Global North and the ideological and disciplinary blinders bred by the development field. These blinders included what James Scott has described as a high modernist vision of the authoritarian state. So pushing back against this orthodoxy, ODH advocates argued that high modernist development interventions exacerbated the problem and further disenfranchised communities because they were alienating, costly, and unresponsive to local needs. Indeed, in Sri Lanka's post-conflict reconstruction efforts has included top-down housing programs as well that have reflected precisely these problems. So against that context, against the critique of hierarchically planned programs, the critique itself resonated powerfully with feminist critiques of women in development and women and development that we referenced earlier, and describing the feminist path to empowerment as a key goal for development linking socioeconomic transformation to popular participation. However, housing was seen as a crucial avenue for such empowerment. For instance, post-conflict housing policy experts commented on the Sri Lankan context, recommended that post-conflict housing reconstruction can contribute to gender equity and empowerment through minimizing the difficulties that women face in accessing housing reconstruction assistance. By using capacities that women have gained during the conflict in post-conflict interventions, they urged that post-conflict housing reconstruction can promote participation of women in planning, designing, and constructing homes. Today, like microcredit, ODH has become part of the policy package of the most powerful development institutions in the world. Moreover, like microcredit, it has proven itself remarkably adaptable to a policy environment shaped by structural adjustment programs and attendant ideas of entrepreneurship and market-driven growth. Finally, like microcredit, ODH individualizes responses to structural problems. In a context where neoliberal ideologies were hostile to more transformative and collective approaches, within the dynamics of the market, the individualizing of responsibility and risk exacerbated the economic precarity of beneficiaries. Moreover, the turn to the local may itself have had particular complementarities with neoliberal recipes for economic growth that were shaped by these conditions of precarity. ODH was designed as a policy response addressing the post-war housing crisis. In Sri Lanka, ODH was not unfamiliar because UN Habitat and others had used community and home ownership based housing construction in post-tsunami housing programs. And in the post-war context, feminist humanitarian workers, NGOs and others foregrounding the post-war gender demographics of household economics as one that needed to shape reconstruction policy. So in their report, for instance, the Sri Lankan census argued that 23% of households were women-headed households, and researchers at the Center for Poverty Analysis note that the high number of women-headed households has come to occupy a prominent place in development discourse and practice in Sri Lanka's post-war context. So international organizations, local NGOs, and the governments of Sri Lanka are implementing a multitude of development programs ranging from housing to food aid to livelihood assistance, targeting women-headed households as a vulnerable category. So I described the ways in which ODHA in particular focused on female-headed households, not only them, but in particular female-headed households as a priority grantee in some sense of these seed grants that they would build housing with. The ODHA program in Sri Lanka needed to be situated in relation to dual policy agendas highlighted above, both post-conflict development assistance on the one hand and women's empowerment on the other. And it emerged against this backdrop where there was not only a focus on increased allocation of aid to women, but also aid allocated within the empowerment framework. Okay, so let me jump to sort of the last sections. So these interlinked policy initiatives of female empowerment and economic reconstruction engendered a debt and dispossession cycle. So they were given, in some sense, these seed grants, but then they could take additional loans, and because there was access to credit that also targeted female-headed households, access to loans which they could use then to either expand on the prototype, or because the prototypes were budgeted too low, to actually use that cost to build it, or because they had other kinds of needs and the precarity with which people were located meant that the housing and the focus on the housing title became itself collateral in some sense for accessing more credit just to meet everyday needs in different ways. Right? So a recent study of ODHA households suggested 85% had acquired significant household debt that had already caused or threatened dispossession of key household resources. So in some sense, the credit, entrepreneurship, and title-advancing agendas then actually engendered much greater debt in many ways. And two-thirds of this debt was acquired entirely to supplement the ODHA house-building grants. And it is not that the ODHA was a singular catalyst for this debt, but that ODHA, in the climate of a range of interventions focused on women's access to credit and entrepreneurship, produced a dynamic which carried its own momentum of debt and precarity. Individual property ownership has meant individualized property development costs, and for the vast majority of beneficiaries, the costs have exceeded the ODHA seed grants. Those ODHA beneficiaries took out loans, both short-term loans to bridge costs while awaiting the next installment of the grant disbursement, and long-term goals to cover the overall shortfall in total building costs. Banks and other financial service agencies have been liberal with credit approvals in ways that have encouraged people to take out loans, even the terms of repayment are exorbitant and there's little prospect of secure income to pay back those loans in a timely manner. And the financial dispersion of prospective debtors make it a creditor's market. Loans ease the short-term credit crunch while heightening the long-term financial precarity. And the majority of debtors have been unable to service their debts without taking out further loans and pawning or sometimes losing valuable family resources. For these, household debt is both an enabler and a constraint. In a resource-constrained context, debt offers resources to meet basic needs for shelter and livelihood, but debt and its interest exacerbate resource constraints and fuels a need for even more debt. Thus, for many, spiraling into greater and greater debt has become a way of life, coping with and compounding the impossibility of everyday life, with the empowerment model ensuring that women were particularly significant beneficiaries of post-conflict economic policy. A parallel dynamic of debt and dispossession has rendered female-headed households particularly vulnerable. Discuss in some sense different dimensions of the debt regimes and the ways in which people get entrapped in sort of cycles of debt, and how entrepreneurship has meant economic insecurity for a community that's already grappling with poverty, as a way of then thinking about how we think about debt and empowerment. Right. So, going back to Lauren Bernard in thinking about cruel optimism and the ways in which debt pulls you in with the promise with immediate promises, and then actually you get dependent on precisely the conditions that are going to disempower you. So debt overwhelms the everyday life of these post-war communities as they navigate the crisis ordinariness of post-conflict economic governance. From household debt to sovereign debt, debt is not a backup option when routine budgets fall short. Rather, debt itself is routinized into budgeting. The routine attains crisis proportions because of the nested dynamics of debt at different scales. For instance, Sri Lanka itself is mired in debt, in a sovereign debt crisis, and has taken out additional loans from the IMF to make payments on its existing loans and supplement existing revenue. This in turn exacerbates the need for household debts for rebuilding because the extent of the country's budget being expended on servicing its debt reduces available public finance for housing and other post-war national policies. Indeed, over 95% of government revenue is needed for servicing its existing debt. So I'm interested also in sort of the ways in which debt nests within itself, right? So the way in which sovereign debt generates, in some sense, household debt or exacerbates the likelihood that households are going to get entrapped in debt. In addition, the conditions of the IMF loan constrained public spending, so the amount of money that can be spent on sort of public housing schemes. The viciously impoverishing debt cycles of these household economies and the proportion of household revenue feeding debt payments mirrors how sovereign debt operates for the national economy. Moreover, tracking how the factors shaping personal debt crisis of individual households is exacerbated by the factors shaping sovereign debt crisis offers a telling window into how dispossession trickles down. Personal debt crisis has its own spread effects, catalyzing a chain of additional debt. For instance, impoverishment within Sri Lanka then pushes those who can get contract jobs in the Middle East or elsewhere to send remittances that can help with large expenses such as building houses. But in fact, remittances from these workers, primarily domestic workers and construction workers, are the single biggest source of foreign exchange in the country. Foreign currency that is even more valuable because the structural adjustment entailed currency devaluations of the Sri Lankan rupee. Linked, of course, to the sovereign debt crisis. These are grueling jobs under difficult conditions, but nevertheless much sought after because remuneration is in a stronger currency. And significantly, the recruitment and wage system, known as sort of the kafala system, for many of those jobs in places like Abu Dhabi, require workers to undertake significant debt. So again, debt to pay employment agencies a recruitment fee that they can then earn back in monthly increments through their work. This system, or through schemes such as, the United Kingdom also, I think, still has what it calls visa bonds for travel to the UK, debt where you pay a certain amount to be able to just to get a visa, and that again you take out debt to be able to afford that amount because it's not part of your routine income. It's always to be significant. It always has to be higher. The debt is a technique of governance that shapes vulnerability in all of the different forms. And in fact, by enabling immediate survival through deferred credit, it also deepens vulnerability by financializing it. Yet Sri Lanka is also not alone in suffering debt as a modality of governance. From Detroit to Athens, crisis ordinariness via debt is the order of the day. A 2016 IMF study titled Debt, Use It Wisely, found that the global debt of the non-financial sector, comprised of general government, households, and non-financial firms, is currently at an all-time high, reaching $152 trillion in 2015, record levels that are significantly higher than before the 2008 financial crisis. Margaret Atwood describes debt as being almost like the air we breathe, that it is everywhere. Crisis ordinariness is part of the atmosphere, yet not everyone is affected by the air in the same way. The crisis dimensions of debt condenses and diffuses differently for the lender and the borrower, with household debt and sovereign debt in the global north and the global south. This chapter has sought to analyze the role of governance feminism in the infrastructure of crisis ordinariness in environments undergoing post-war economic reconstruction and concomitantly to probe the politics of female empowerment as mobilized in this context. The affective structure that debt draws on and engenders is shaped in a dialectic between crisis and stability, despair and promise, austerity and consumption, discipline and empowerment. It inflects what we could describe as a techno-moral appeal of this fusion of technocratic languages of law and policy with moral pronouncements that is central to legitimizing governance feminist prescriptions as being in the public interest. UN Habitat reports on the housing scheme includes profiles of women who are shown to be recipients of these grants and describes them as sort of feeling empowered. female-led householders, say, for instance, are empowered to take charge of the construction of their houses, they feel a sense of achievement on completion. Feminist arguments for empowerment that claim this affective resonance were integrated with technocratic programs for private sector promotion. Thus, fused these policy commitments ensured that local and global development programs were attached to neoliberal agendas for post-war economic recovery. Given that this channeling of many feminisms to neoliberal economic policy led to debt, dispossession, and socioeconomic precarity, we need to understand how feminism came to define empowerment in these terms. And in some cases, these paths were unexpected. For instance, the logic of microfinance was that it would substitute social capital for financial capital in capital-scarce communities. However, the commercialization of microfinance instrumentalized social capital and quickly brought it into the logic of capital. In other cases, there were elements of what we may see as feminist political morality that rhymed with neoliberal agendas. For instance, inclusion, agency, and commitments are elements of the affective glue tethering international conflict feminism to neoliberalism. The promise of inclusion into the market, agency as a market actor, and a commitment to redemptive citizenship in the post-conflict landscape. So as the chapter has traced, neoliberal logics tied to property, credit, and entrepreneurship traveled under the aura of empowerment. In Undoing the Demos, Wendy Brown has recently argued that the power of neoliberalism is best understood not as economic policies for exploitation and profit, but as termite-like political rationality that renders us all as entrepreneurs. Neoliberalism, she says, is generally more termite-like than lion-like. Its mode of reasoning boring in capillary fashion into the trunks and branches of workplaces, schools, agencies, public agencies, social and political discourse, and above all, the subject. So close quotes. There's an important resonance here with the path that empowerment discourse has traveled, where market logics have integrated with discourses and strategies that articulated dissidence and heterodoxy. The purveyors of economic governance invested the vision of empowerment and assimilated its way of knowing and shaping the world. The goals, assumptions, and methodologies that attend this approach to empowerment became part of the institutional and symbolic machinery of cruel optimism. Central to the economy of desire here is its mutuality, so that governance, feminist empowerment, and neoliberal development marry agendas and visions to richer and poorer, including richer promises and poorer futures. The policies advanced by the post-conflict development apparatus can themselves exacerbate economic vulnerability in post-conflict environments. Indeed, as is the case studied here, the female empowerment programs that are lodged in these development policies can be instrumental in these dynamics. In such cases, empowerment is not just an empty promise, rather it trades in a currency of cruel optimism, but the promise of empowerment is part of the very apparatus that disempowers further. The Sri Lankan example draws attention to the striking tension between the success in shaping policy, the government's feminist success in shaping policy in the name of empowerment, on the one hand, and the exacerbation of women and men's economic vulnerability through those very policies on the other. Moreover, as these policies get normalized into mainstream development policy, the precarity engendered by the legacies of conflict and exacerbated by hegemonic development policies becomes a constant. When crisis becomes ordinary in this way, these enabling conditions also become more difficult to challenge. And this normalization of precarity makes it more difficult to imagine an alternative ordinary. This sense of crisis ordinariness is perhaps a feature of late capitalism's impasse in many contexts. Berlant herself is thinking of the contemporary USA. However, the work of development policy and empowerment promises in exacerbating precarity is particularly poignant in post-conflict contexts, where the development policy apparatus legitimates itself by contrasting its promises with the precarity of war, cruel optimism. So,
thank you very much.
Sorry. Please. It went much longer than I thought, even with my cuts. So, okay.
Fantastic. We have time for questions and answers, comments, discussion. Shall I ask the question that is not supposed to be asked?
Yeah.
What is your alternative?
The alternative is a tough one. I mean, certainly that. I do think that this huge. Alternative to the housing thing, or alternative to something.
Alternative to cruel optimism, to paradox of empowerment, to the whole apparatus you described for us.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know whether there is an alternative. I mean, I think part of the challenge of the moment is to be able to imagine things outside of capitalism. It seems that unless, except in very localized and disparate contexts, it's difficult to think about. It's difficult to imagine different kinds of things that as alternatives. I do think, nevertheless, even if one doesn't have an alternative, it is valuable to trace the unexpected consequences of marrying, for instance, feminism to particular notions of empowerment, or because you know, at least you can. I think maybe all it can do is ameliorative, or you can stop things in its tracks in some sense, as people did. Like even in this context, I mean, I didn't do all the, because there's some local women's organization there in Jaffna, which is all rural women and some urban women, but really very very poor women. They have a cooperative where they were. Where they, in fact, argued for a moratorium on debts, on microcredit. And so people, so all of those, it's not, changing the world, but it may temporarily shape or, in some sense, assuage the flood of particular things. So, yeah.
Shall we go in this order?
You're the boss. Okay.
Well, it follows up on that. So particularly.
Sure. Yeah, no, I don't think there was any nefarious dimension to.
It wouldn't have had to be nefarious. It could have just been a sort of an ideology.
They anticipated that they were paying the full cost of this, but they were open to the idea that people may need to top up if they changed and so on, and they thought that was a good thing, that people should have the freedom, that it shouldn't be, that this is not going to be some Stalinist top-down thing where people are going to say, this is exactly what you're going to have, and so that was so it was, but so I think what was. On the so yeah, so I don't think it was a plan. I do think that it was there were self-interested investments at a different kind of level as well. I mean, certainly at the donor level in terms of shaping it in this particular way and having sort of these massive schemes that were universally done. You couldn't that were everyone was vying against it with each other to say we are going to build 5,000 houses, we're going to build 2,000 houses, we're going to a particular logic around how political capital is linked to those kinds of claims, but also in the more micro sense, like if you were within the World Bank or you were with UN Habitat and you had a particular notion about your professional development and so on, that you also became invested in particular ideas about what works, irrespective of whether it in fact unfolded the way it did in some sense. So so I think there are various kinds of sort of ambitions invested in it, sometimes individual, sometimes institutional, that makes it difficult to see a problem in advance or be open to an unexpected thing. But I don't think also, I mean, to go back to the macro question about whether there is an alternative, I don't think there is a policy tweak that can make it work, right? That in some sense it's embedded into the structure, that thing. So I think where people have in very localized context had where things maybe have had less catastrophic consequences in terms of household income, or where people have shaped their own things, but essentially they're disengaging in some sense from the system. Where they're it's not dependent for whatever reason. Sometimes because they're able to, they've got a remittance coming from somewhere. That means that they don't have to go through the UN Habitat and the donor agency model of how to get credit. They're for various reasons like that. People who have disengaged from the system in very localized, whatever, it's nothing very systematic or structural. Did I miss you? You have another question, right?
No, that was it.
Okay.
Just as some sense of whether they thought it was a good idea to have people have a stake in the local economy by generating debt, getting involved in entrepreneurial schemes.
Yeah. I mean, they did think that. They didn't underfund because of that, but. No, actually, some groups did increase how much money they gave. So they were not, as I said, they're not interested in creating vulnerability. Right? But that doesn't mean that people didn't nevertheless accrue debt, because they also increased, you know, they had all the other things. They were, you know, access to credit. As you know, all over the world, and presumably Britain too, the issue of how access to credit is one of the most vicious instruments of capitalism today, and how it's marketed and things in some sense. So,
Right. So thanks for a fascinating talk. So it seems quite obvious who the losers are in this story, but I wondered about who the winners are, and whether there are any figures available, for example, on these credit providers, whether there's private banks involved, whether they're housing development corporations, building companies, and so on, that did well out of this, as they tend to.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably too early to tell sort of long-term winners. There were short-term winners in terms of, like, who the banks that were giving credit and so on. Whether that will, I mean, some of those seem, you know, unsustainable in the sense that it's unclear. They're giving credit to people who may not be able to give credit back. So it is not clear to me that all those banks will end up being winners even in the long term. Some may, and some may be just bought out by bigger banks, and we may not even see the winners on the playing field today, in some sense, right? Like, I mean, as credit and debt
because we saw in the US, they repackage these loans into these
and sell them again.
Sell them again
into different financial instruments.
Right,
that.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the banks or most of the banks that they were engaging with, some of them are international banks, many of them are local banks. Those banks, some of them will disappear, even, right? Because they're not going to get a return on their credit, and they may have to sell then the debts that they own to bigger banks. So all of that hasn't completely unfolded yet. I mean, I should also add that there are worse ways of doing the housing scheme as well. So, and even more controversial, I mean, this scheme was hugely controversial and ended up producing a lot of debate. There is an even more controversial thing where someone has given, this Akhtar Mittal some massive amount of money. They have given some politician a massive amount of money, and they are constructing housing that people have no, that's really bad quality, that people have no input in. So it's not as if this is, I mean, there are... you can't even do worse, but that came after this, right? It's partly people were engaging with this thing, and some of the issues around credit, it is not clear that there is another way of. There are certain things that can be done. I mean, it's not that this is inevitable. Like if the IMF structural adjustment policies had different ideas about how much public expenditure there could be about, that would change things surely, in terms of the kinds of things people are spending on, in terms of that they wouldn't, in their household budgets would be different. So.
Thanks, Saskia. That was a brilliant talk. And I guess my question was around the government's feminism part of your paper, because it could be very easily read, your story could be read as a story of feminism being launched into positions of governance through some mode of cooperation. So it wasn't clear to me how it, the reverse work, which is did feminists occupy positions of governance in the narrative that you're offering?
I think in certain places, it's difficult to. I don't know whether cooptation is the word. There is among sort of critical sort of feminists, there's some lots of debate about 1325, whether we should see that as cooptation or sleeping with the enemy, or whether what's to be gained and what's to be lost. I think it's quite problematic the way international conflict feminism has traveled, but it's not difficult to see how reasonable people could think that to get some action on X by your Z, to get some extra attention on I think that you needed to get the Security Council aboard, or you needed this particular rule. I mean, Security Council may be really a Faustian bargain, but maybe that you can imagine someone saying, let's focus our energies on getting the AKSU verdict or getting, I mean, different parts of the ICF, right, that in terms of how we think that those, you that, and I think people with very different kinds of politics fed into that, and sometimes with unexpected unexpected results, or like there was a McKinnon-esque engagement, but there was also people like Rhonda Copeland who came from social movements and had very different kinds of things who fed into international conflict feminism going in a particular way. And then the women in development stuff, like that's also, I mean, trajectories that people do not anticipate, like, you know, I mean, so, you know, I do contrast in the paper, like, the ways in which Geeta Sen spoke about empowerment, or the way empowerment was spoken about in the Mexico conference, where, and the way empowerment gets spoken about later, but there's no, even though there is a difference, there's no question that the discussion of empowerment that people like Sen or the Mexico conference spoke of fed into empowerment discourse in the World Bank today. Right, that those all were factors in terms of how, but so it was political when they spoke about it, and it became depoliticized and technocratic the way it ended up. But those were not, and maybe couldn't have been anticipated, of course. I don't know whether it couldn't be anticipated, because of course the post-development people decided to disengage much more radically from the whole development enterprise. So at various points, one could also potentially think that there were moments where feminists could have said, this ship is going in a different direction, and we need to get off, while many have said, no, it's better stay in and influence its course in some sense, right? So, so I don't know, that's not completely an answer.
So different strands of feminism,
I think,
travel differently. Some just lost the game.
I don't think necessarily always as co-optation, but it's also difficult to, yeah. I guess I'm a bit worried about there's things that are functionally co-optation, even if they're not intentionally so, right, so.
Can I follow up on that question? Especially in terms of this international conflict feminism, I heard you say that it constructs women as objects of knowledge, and as victims, among other things. But I'm interested in the normative reasons why you're critical of international conflict feminism, especially since LSE has become a new center of international conflict feminism.
Oh, really? it should be my object of knowledge.
Right. Okay. It could be a case study. But where does one even begin to articulate what exactly the problem is there?
With thinking of women as victims.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that feminism itself has a huge critique of that, that has somehow got forgotten in some ways, right? That there is a way in which, you know,
Did I get it right, that those are the foundations of your critique?
Yeah, well, that there is these two strands, that there is a, that within the women in economic development strand, there's a huge investment in thinking of women as agents.
Right.
And within international conflict feminism, there's a huge investment in women as victims. And both of those are, of course, I mean, reductive in some sense, but they speak to, I think, a dominant and recognizable tenor within each of those trajectories. So I think most people in each of those fields would recognize that this has become, that there is a notion of women as victims, or there is a, that women enter the script as victims in some sense. I mean, you know, in theory, 1325 and the Security Council resolution that it engendered were not only about women as victims, they were also about women as participating in peace processes and so on, but often framed in this particular way as well. And the particular strands of feminism that then ended up having traction were ones that were invested in the notion of women as victims. So Catherine MacKinnon becomes the gender advisor in the ICC, and she's really invested in women as victims. So the particular strand of empowered women who get, or the ways in which that gender advisor position was something that lots of feminist groups pushed for in many ways, and there was a lot at stake in who would get appointed to that position. I think in all of those little micro battles, there was a shaping of what was something at stake there in terms of the different ways in which. The way in which victimhood or gender got shaped. It seems, of course, within feminism, there's, you know, Joan Scott and a whole range of other people for, you know, when our grandmothers were feminists, were criticizing notions of victimhood and saying, you know, let's talk about survivors, agency, resilience, and so on. But that has, that is not what is going to get Security Council resolutions passed. You know, you get that off and on in sort of photo ops around, you know, women in Liberia having some peripheral role in the peace process or something, but it, that's what's, where the substantive investment is.
Can I push back?
Yeah.
But women are the victims of conflict.
Not the only victims.
They're not all, so your response would be that they're not only victims. And
yeah.
So I'm trying to get a sense of what exactly is wrong with this.
Oh, thinking of women as victimhood. Yeah, I mean, so not, I mean, you know, like in the Sri Lankan conflict, 40% of the LTTE cadre were women. All the major suicide bombings were women. I mean, these are not necessarily all that one can say, but it's, that's just one dimension. A lot of the men, I mean, the vast majority of people were killed by men. That's why you have female-headed households. They were the survivors. So it is weird to then call female households the ones who are most victimized when there's, their partners are dead. I mean, so it just seems that that, you know, it doesn't mix. I think feminism is misdirected in thinking that there is a victimhood Olympics around, that is favorable to feminism. I don't think that, I think feminism can speak about the gender distribution without its, and it's actually stronger thinking of the gender distribution without thinking of women as the ones who are most victimized. And it's, in more, I think it's valuable to think of women and men as victimized differently. And this is still, you know, talking, as I say, in an older key of feminism where we are even keeping all of those categories of gender stable. But, you know, the very first case of sexual violence that came before the ICTY was sexual violence against men, you know, like a man who had to, like, bite off the testicles of another man. I mean, it's, so those, it seems that there are certain, you know, sexual violence, there's a lot of talk, again, within, I mean, I come from the transfer justice field in some sense in my earlier life as a lawyer, that, and within that field there's often talk about how it's so difficult for women to speak about sexual violence, but it's way more difficult for men to speak about sexual violence. I mean, if you just look at the court records, I mean, the court records are the thing, or truth commissions are the, truth commission testimonies are our reference point. Women are doing a lot of talking. So it doesn't mean that they're empowered, it doesn't mean that they're not victims. It just, it just operates differently.
Inscribes women as sexual objects, and one of the things that women as economic agents does is pull you a little bit away from the idea that women are part sexual beings and need to be protected as that, or get attacked as sexual beings. So I think part of the criticism of the Women, Peace and Security agenda has been the obsession of sexual violence in war, and victimhood comes in all kinds of other forms which end up getting ignored. So the kind of grand victimhood, and particularly the individual perpetrators, so you lose this sense of structural victimhood of gender structures within society that, as you say, both men and women in different ways at different times are exposed to, and end up with a kind of, we've prosecuted a rapist who raped this number of women, this constant idea of women's role in war as effectively being attacked sexually. So, and I, you know, I take these criticisms
sure.
also in some ways a kind of freshness at looking at women in conflict as agents of the economy rather than in their role as sexual beings. I don't know what the solutions are, so how you open people's ideas up, because you get an awful lot of money when you talk about sexual violence in conflict, because it's so shocking, and particularly
right,
about sexual violence against women
right,
in conflict,
right,
and yet
right.
it narrows our understanding
right,
of what
right.
happens to people in conflict
right.
so much.
Right. Right. Although, I mean, interestingly, you do also get money, you know, clearly when you have women as economic agents, but of a particular kind, right, linked in this way to property, title, credit, entrepreneurship. So women who are trying to form cooperatives or form unions are not getting those funds. So there's a zillion development agency projects for women who, you know, to buy a sewing machine and start your own entrepreneurial whatever, or your catering business or whatever. There's like money that there are donors standing in line to give it to you. But if you want to unionize, then your government has already agreed to the IMF about, you know, changing your labor laws. And that becomes a much more complicated thing, or it has your the women in the free trade zone who are government workers. Who are under, I mean, that's so it's they are interested in economic empowerment in a particular kind of way as well. Right? It's not all kinds of agency that they're interested in. They are interested in a particular model of agency.
I just had a question about the scale of this scheme. So, roughly how many or what percentage of the women took up these loans and are now in that situation? And how many women would have resisted that or not been offered that? Not been offered that or declined that money? And then how many of those? I mean, I'm really excited to hear about that. Is that just a single project, or are there all those around? Because I think you can see, obviously you can see that as resistance, but you can also see the women not taking up that offer of funding as a form of resistance to that. Because credit has obviously been around for decades, and people must would have seen what that does to, you know, high interest loans have a tendency to get you into the same levels of credit in a short period of time. Right? So people might have actually already...
Right.
Yeah, I mean, if they're in a position where they could be trying to work, and is there then a sense of a class difference between two
students?
Right. Like,
right.
Or is it only the women of the elite who are able to form these cooperatives, or is it like the very core who are in a position, not in a position to decline it?
Right. So I don't have the number. I think it's somewhere in here. I remember like it's one of my editor's questions was how many are here, and I went and looked up how many were here. But it's I think over 50,000. But I don't remember the numbers exactly. 50. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a big chunk of money. India gave the biggest chunk. It was a big chunk of money. It was also it played into then Indian politics about what is India doing to the Tamils of Sri Lanka and so on. So it had a whole range of everyone has their own agendas around it. And then about the EU and Austria also like Norway had the peace process. EU and Austria was doing this other peace supporting things, even though the peace process didn't go anywhere with Norway, but they were going to do other kinds of reconstruction things at this particular point. So there were different actors had their own particular notions of things. So to go back to the issue, but so women didn't refuse it. People had to apply for this, and they turned people down. So anyone who applied for this and got it, I haven't seen anything. This Center for Poverty Analysis, they're the ones who have done the most extensive, they're not the only ones, but they've done the most extensive survey of these households. So everyone who was offered it took it. And the people who are in the cooperative is a different kind of thing. That is, in some sense, a recent development. It's still sort of a bit inchoate. I mean, it's just a handful of women. That is, I'm not sure exactly numbers, but it would be like maybe 24 women or something. But it's a. So I've been talking to Prabha a little bit about this a couple of days ago. So within Sri Lanka, there is a long tradition of cooperatives. That are mostly, especially in the north and east, I mean, different kinds of traditions. It's like a Gandhian thing, different kinds of ways in which people are small craft producers. Craft producers, but not only craft producers, it's also like people who are fishing people, consumer cooperatives were extremely popular in the north all before the war. So there is even the cooperative itself is an attempt to think of a development trajectory and a development program. I mean, perhaps then, in some ways, not outside of capitalism, but certainly out of capitalism's imagination, that was there, that predated the war, that was seen as a sort of local tradition, in some sense, a local economic tradition. Not only local, because, it was shaped by other things in South Asia. There were people like from Spain and various places who were coming and giving input, primarily a local thing. It's seen, it is something that people feel certain ownership over. So there is some effort now, with great difficulty, however, to restart those fishing cooperatives. And probably the most effective or most vocal effort in that has been the fishing one, where there has been a push against
so in the Pork Strait, the Indian bottom trawling around the Pork Strait, so against big fishing companies. And so some of the push around that has come from fishing corporations. So they basically set the price. They do things that, I mean, as I said, it's sort of sometimes peripheral to capitalism, but they can't quite always do it. It's not, you know, it's really inchoate and slow in some sense. But so this, I mean, on the women cooperative, I couldn't find a newspaper thing that that is basically the. So when I wrote this, I sent it to a bunch of my Sri Lankan friends to read it and give me like things. But I have one of my friends who's just did a PhD partly on cooperatives. He said that there was. He told me that there was this feminist group. So it's probably something that someone can go locally and track, and or read his dissertation. but yeah. So there's still, as I said, it's very inchoate. It's not quite informal economy. I mean, the state knows it, and the fisheries thing, for instance, the state is negotiating with the cooperative. It's visible, but.
Any more questions or comments? In that case, thank you very much.
Thanks,
thank you
guys.
For the audience.
I know, I'm so sorry for you guys. I need to do this rather than have a drink in the pub.
Yeah, okay.